Hi, I'm Michael Panish, and welcome to the Clark Reaper podcast at clarkreaper.com. If you have any comments or questions about Clark Reaper, send me an email at m.panish@comcast.net. That's Panish spelled P-A-N-U-S-H. Today's story is Dead Man's Gulch, the first chapter in the book, and also the first Clark Reaper story ever written. I do hope you enjoy it. And now, Dead Man's Gulch. Now, I ain't no resin to Dead Man's Gulch, no sir. That town had something queer about it, like something important was missing and you couldn't figure out what exactly it was. The people was always staring at you out of the corner of their eyes, and seemed to be talking about you behind your back. I didn't like going to Dead Man's Gulch, but men in my line of work don't often have a choice in where they get to go. The name's Clark Reaper, and I'm a bounty hunter. I reckon I've heard and seen my fair share of strange things out in the wild prairies that make up most of this old country, but that was before I went to Dead Man's. Things changed me there, and there weren't no going back. This all happened a couple of years ago, just when it seemed like everyone with money to spare was headed out west. I was chasing a two-bit gunslinger by the name of Fire-Eyed Dick, and word had it that he was holed up in Dead Man's. Kind of a funny story about who exactly Fire-Eyed Dick was, and I think now would be a good time to tell it to you. Dick's bounty was $200 in pure gold dust, to be paid out in full to whoever brought him in, dead or alive. The bounty was leveled on Fire-Eyed Dick by an old scientist named Doc Torrent. Torrent, who operated out of a lab in a particularly desolate part of the Dakotas, had heard about my success putting down the monstrous jackalope nicknamed the Ricochet Rabbit that had been terrorizing the Nevada-California border, and knew I was a feller that specialized in jobs of a strange and unnatural nature. He told me some bull's crap of a story about how a gunman with piercing eyes had attacked his lab, killed a few of his assistants, stolen his prize experiment, and ran off. He wanted me to find this gunman, Fire-Eyed Dick, and bring him back. I knew the doc wasn't telling me the whole story, but I needed the money and took the job anyway. Dick's trail was as wild as a drunk man's wanderings. I chased him all over North Dakota, across desert and forest, until I caught up with him in a saloon in Deadwood. He was a thin rod of a man, completely covered by a black cloak and a wide-brimmed hat. Black leather gloves even covered his hands. A burning light seemed to shine through his hat brim, and I began to think he weren't all human. I decided dead was better than alive in this situation. I fired at Fire-Eyed Dick from behind with my trusty 12-gauge, and that should have torn the feller apart. Instead, the gunman swung around and laid into me with a fist made of solid steel. But when he hit me, his entire body spun completely around, so that the tips of his boots were pointed the opposite way as his blazing eyes. He got up and ran out of the place, his feet still pointed backwards. After I'd picked myself up off the floor and wheezed for a minute or two, I was hot on his trail. I caught up with Fire-Eyed Dick and shot off his hat with my Colt Peacemaker as he was riding out of town on a stolen horse. Without his hat, I saw that Fire-Eyed Dick didn't have much of a face at all. It was a metal rod with two light bulbs sticking out, and it was the light bulbs that gave him that glow. See, it turns out that Fire-Eyed Dick didn't steal Doc Torrent's experiment. He was the experiment. Torn had been trying to make a mechanical man with something like a clattering cash register for a brain and a steam engine for a heart. He had succeeded a little too well. That was why Doc Torrent was paying so much for me to kill the mechanical man. He knew that Fire-Eyed Dick would wise up quickly. Someone had to shut him down before he caused too much trouble. I reckon I was being paid to be that someone. I tracked Fire-Eyed Dick out of Deadwood, but he was getting better and better at hiding. I would have to finish him quickly before he got wise enough to finish me. I found out he was heading straight for Dead Man's Gulch. A wagon train was leaving Kansas City on its way to Dead Man's Gulch, and I was able to tag along. There are all sorts of outlaws, Indians, and other dangerous critters running amok in the frontier prairies, and that's not even counting some of the stranger things I've seen. Like a train hijacking crew of circus freaks, bloodthirsty cults, and a hairy giant the Indians called Sasquatch. The wagon train was filled with your typical number of immigrants to the west, thin-skinned pioneers looking to strike gold with their first footstep, and nervous families forced to move out and find work and new lives. I preferred walking with the latter. I found myself beside a wagon belonging to a greenhorn from Baltimore by the name of Oswald Green. He was a little feller with a bowler hat and a thin mustache, the kind you would see toiling away in any big business. He didn't have no place out here, and seemed drawn to me. Plus, he had this little boy who was riding along in the wagon, by the name of Charles, and the boy seemed real excited when I mentioned that I was a bounty hunter. Charles Green was a nice little kid, decked out in a Norfolk suit and peak cap. He had a full head of curly brown hair, thick spectacles, and freckles on his face. Didn't have the heart to leave him hanging. "So you're saying the people in charge of United Coal are giant lizards?" Oswald asked me after I had mentioned my crusade against the cold-blooded reptilians that controlled the United Coal Company to his son. "Shape-shifting lizards," I said. "You wouldn't know it to look at them." "Wow," Charles said, completely amazed. I couldn't help smiling, even though I could tell that his father didn't believe a word I had said. "Well, enough about me," I said. "You folks gonna settle down in Dead Man's Gulch?" "Oh no, we're just passing through on our way to California." Oswald seemed glad to get away from the subject of giant lizards. I wouldn't want Charles to grow up in that town. His mother wanted the best for him, and right now that's in California. His mother is dead. Oswald sighed, and Charles looked away. A couple of Confederate renegades who didn't realize the war was over attacked our home a couple years back. Charles was just born then. Oswald fixed me with a look a few miles from kindly. "What sign were you on, if I may ask?" "Both," I said simply. It was true enough. "But why don't you want to settle down in Dead Man's?" I asked, trying to change the subject. "It ain't the most friendly town, but there are worse places." Oswald shook his head. "You haven't heard about the Englishman who bought all the land on Black Pine Peak last year? Lord Dark-something, I think his name is. They say he's ruling the whole region like a king, and a depraved king at that. Also, rumor has it that the local residents are getting into arguments with the nearby Indians, and I really don't want to wait around to see what the outcome's going to be." "Darkmoor," I whispered to myself. If Lord Darkmoor was here, that meant this was a place with a real presence for the supernatural, and it wasn't a good presence. "You know him?" Oswald asked. "Yeah, I know him. Had a run-in with his men, Noah Feratu and the Midnight Gang, a while back." My voice died away as I saw what was ahead of us. The wagon train turned around yet another curve, and I saw a sight that will stay with me until my dying days. I gulped and held out my hand for the wagon to stop. "Charles, you should get into the wagon and close your eyes, and probably cover your ears, too." "Why?" Oswald asked curiously. He peered around the bend and gagged. After he had finished retching, he ordered his son to get back into the wagon. Charles must have realized how serious things were, because he obeyed his father and didn't even complain. Some things are just so dead wrong that all the words and all the fancy-pants books in the world can't do them justice, and this was one of those things. I had known that Lakota sometimes passed by this area, and the townsfolk battled with them, but I couldn't imagine nothing like this. The people here had been a Lakota tribe. Well, mostly women, old folks, and little kids had made up a Lakota tribe when the men weren't around, before the townsfolk of Dead Man's Gulch had finished with them. Now they was just pieces, dripping and draining in the dusty dirt. Some of them were still alive, horrible as it may seem, but vultures, coyotes, and desert critters were finishing them off the painful way. I spotted a dying old man whispering words in his own language over the bodies of a couple of young children, and I knew he was having the most painful moments of his life. I took out my peacemaker with a practiced spin, and walked over to ease his passing. "Easy there, old man. Just performing the good Lord's mercy," I said, pressing the Colt's muzzle to the back of his head. His arms and legs were twisted around like broken twigs, and he was covered in blood. Even so, he turned around and started shouting furiously in his language, a lot louder than someone in his position should be able to shout. I put one round in his skull right when he was in the middle of his chant, and the old man keeled over. I returned my peacemaker to its holster and walked back to the wagon train. Most of us holed up in the Kilgrave Hotel, a two-bit dump that suited the two-bit town of Dead Man's Gulch. I got a room next to Oswald and Charles Green, and then went off to see if I could catch Fire-Eyed Dick Scent. I didn't see the mechanical man, but I did figure out the reason why he came to Dead Man's Gulch. Lord Darkmoor was looking for bodyguards, and he'd put up posters advertising his need for guns and muscle all over the town. It didn't take me long to figure out why Darkmoor needed guns. He was a vampire lord if you want to use their bloodsucker terminology, and he needed folks with guns to watch over him while he slept during the day. I didn't have any reason to kill Darkmoor, and I hoped I wouldn't run into him. With no sign of Fire-Eyed Dick, I headed to the local saloon to knock back a few. Alcohol has always been my vice of choice, and I haven't found any reason to stop yet. But on the way to the saloon, two things happened that would make my stay in Dead Man's Gulch a lot less easy. First, Charles Green ran up to me, crying and afraid. He shivered all over like he had been out in the cold for too long. His father wasn't anywhere to be seen. "Mr. Reaper! Mr. Reaper!" he cried. He would have collided with me if I hadn't caught the little feller in my arms. "What's wrong, son? Where's your pa?" I asked, kindly as I could. Charles cried for a few seconds, but I calmed him down and got him to talk. "I wanted to see what you wouldn't let me see, the dead Indians. So I headed out while my father was checking into the hotel, and then he went after me, and I saw the Indians, and they were dead, but they were also alive!" He burst into tears again. "Don't worry, son," I said to Charles. "Corpses can stiffen up sometimes. It happens a lot. They ain't really alive, though. Now where's your pa gone to?" "They got him," Charles cried. "The dead Indians came and ate him up." I stared at Charles. I'd seen a heck of a lot of strange things, but I wasn't inclined to believe a crying boy's story about the living dead eating his daddy. I was about to say something else that would ease Charles's fears, but then a bullet whizzed by my head and clipped my hat. "Son of a gun!" I shouted. Sure enough, Fire-Eyed Dick stood right in front of me, a Winchester rifle in his iron hands. "Charles, you better get behind me," I said. "Things are about to head straight for hell." Even I didn't know how right I was. The boy seemed too scared to move. He stood still like he was rooted in the ground, right in the path of Fire-Eyed Dick's bullets. I ignored Charles's squeal of terror, roughly picked him up and tossed him to the side. I wouldn't have tossed him around normally, but I didn't have much choice in the matter. Fire-Eyed Dick fired again, but the mechanical man's shot went wild and kicked up dust near my right leg. I drew out both the peacemakers and let him have it. My two shots caught him straight in the chest, tearing off his black coat and letting me get a look at him. He weren't nothing more than arms, legs, a head, and a body made out of thin metal rods with a couple smoking machines welded onto him. Having a chest about as wide as a stack of nickels meant that he was a lot harder to hit. Well, we exchanged gunfire for a while, his bullets hitting close but always missing, and my shots not even grazing his metal stick of a body. Those twin light bulbs were glaring at me like two little suns, and I got myself an idea. I fanned one of my revolvers, the bullets rapidly flying around Dick and driving him back. Then I holstered one six-gun, grabbed the other one with both hands, closed one eye to aim, and put a single bullet into one of his light bulb eyes. The glass shattered, and Fire-Eyed Dick let out a loud whining sound, the first sound I had ever heard him make. I tried to shoot out the other light bulb eye, but Dick scampered down an alley and leapt over a water trough, running like a wounded antelope. He was gone. By now it was nearly dark, and the pale moon had crept out of its hiding spot. Then something else caught my attention. See, Charles weren't lying about the living dead Indians. They really had gotten up, still rotten and spilling out every which way, and were coming into town. The townsfolk started screaming and running around in circles, hollering about dead walking and other such things. I turned to Charles, still crouched on the ground. He had stopped crying and stood very still. Slowly, he raised his little arm and pointed behind me. I looked, and there was a large mob of corpses, men, women, and even little kids, all headed our way. "Aw, hell," I muttered, "and I thought Dead Man's Gulch was just a colorful name. What do these dead folks want?" I soon got my answer when a gaunt-looking Lakota maiden with only half a face grabbed the town banker and bit straight into his skull. The poor feller let out a piercing cry and doubled over on the ground, clutching the gaping hole in his head. Then, in a few seconds, he came to his feet and let out a low, hungry moan. It didn't take long for me to put two and two together and realize Charles and me had to get out of that place fast. "Can you walk?" I asked Charles, pulling him to his feet. I guess so," he stammered. I was probably being a little too hard on a boy whose own father had just been eaten, but I didn't have much of a choice. I was having a lot less choices lately. "Well, we're going to have to run. Those dead folk don't look too fast, so it shouldn't be no problem to outrun 'em. Follow me, we'll get to the stables, get a horse, and leave this town to the corpses. Come on!" We took off running. To his credit, Charles managed to keep up with me, even though he began panting and wheezing after a couple of minutes of sprinting. He followed me down the dirt main street and round the corner to the stables. But then I stopped. A large army of those dead folk blocked our path, and they weren't just Indians. Nope. It seemed like most of the citizens of Dead Man's Gulch had got bitten and had turned into the same flesh-hungry creatures as their attackers. I turned around and found more hungry corpses, drooling over my flesh. We were surrounded. "Son of a gun," I shouted, drawing out my peacemakers. I blasted the first dead feller, an overweight man in a butcher's apron, but the bullets just sent him rocking on his feet. Fighting Fire-Eyed Dick gave me another idea, so I tried shooting the dead man in the head. His brain splattered on the dirt road and he toppled over. I reckon even dead folks can't go on when they're missing a brain. Well, there was only one option open, the Kilgrave Hotel. "Charles," I said, "we're going to have to go inside and stay there until we can leave this town for good. How you getting on?"
Okay, he wheezed. He was doubled over and his face was red. Poor kid.
"All right. Now you just stay near me, and I'll keep them dead things away from you. Don't worry, son." I blasted another walking corpse and started walking slowly backwards to the hotel, Charles right next to me. Then, a dead boy, only a little older than Charles, lunged out and grabbed him. I blasted the dead kid's head off with both my peacemakers, but not before he had sunk his teeth into poor Charles's arm. I holstered one of the revolvers, picked up Charles, who was crying piteously, and threw him over my shoulder. Then I raced backward into the hotel. I kicked open the door and slammed it behind me, then found myself looking down the barrel of a wide-mouthed shotgun. "I ain't no dead man," I said, "and there's no need to make me one." "The kid's been bit," the man with the shotgun said. He was a short feller with thinning hair and spectacles. "The name's Murphy. I own this place, and I think we're in the last building not overrun. I'll be damned if I let some kid turn into one of those things on us." "If he does, then I'll put him down myself," I shouted. I drew out one of my revolvers and pointed it at Murphy. "Now let me pass, or I swear I will blow your goddamn head off." I reckon he knew I weren't kidding, so he lowered the shotgun and let me in, but glared at me as I headed upstairs. There were about 10 or so townsfolk hiding out in the hotel, and they had barricaded the pathway to the upper story pretty well. I laid Charles down on a bench and looked him over. "Does it hurt?" I asked. He was very pale and wasn't crying too much. Even though I didn't want to admit it, I knew he was going to change. "It hurts," he whispered. "Am I going to be one of those things that ate my father?" "I don't rightly know," I whispered.
"I do," Charles said. "I can feel it happening to me right now. I'll be one of them soon." He was very quiet for a few moments.
"Can you make it painless?"
"That I can," I said, feeling sick to my stomach with what I was going to have to do. I gently pressed the muzzle of my revolver to the boy's forehead. "You won't feel nothing until you reach the gates of heaven." I was going to wait for him to change, wanting to give the kid as much life as possible before shooting him, but then something distracted me.
"Hey, look at this!" Murphy shouted, pointing out of the window. I left Charles lying on the bench and went to see. A youngish man in a striped shirt, vest, and bowler hat decorated with feathers stood on the roof of the one-story general store across the street. By his brown skin and face paint, I could tell he was a Lakota. He took out a bow and arrow, tied a rope to the arrow, and shot it straight at the roof of our building, so that the rope hung down like a vine in a jungle. Then he gave the rope a test pull and leapt into the air, swinging on the rope like he was some kind of monkey. Much to my amazement, the Lakota made it all the way across. He swung low, and some of the dead people reached up to try and grab him,
but he swatted away their hands. Once he had made it across, he climbed up the rope until he got to the window and leapt inside. "My name is Running Dog. You are the last living people in this city," he said, not sounding tired or short of breath at all. "I am here to help." He had a real strange accent, almost like a stuffy old Easterner, or even an Englishman straight out of victorious Britain. The survivors gasped in horror and surprise, scared out of their minds when they heard that they were the last ones left alive. "Now hold on," Murphy said, swinging his shotgun so it pointed to the Lakota. "Indians were the first ones to stop being dead and start eating people after we killed them all. I say we can't trust any heathen dirt worshipper." Faster than I could see, the Lakota grabbed the shotgun and tore it out of Murphy's hands. "You foolish paleface," he cried. "Even Sitting Bull would not wish this on you. If a Lakota burial chant is interrupted, and the dead are not yet dead, and they become hungry, they spread that hunger to everyone else they bite, unless the proper rites are performed, or the head is removed. I swear he looked straight at me, like he knew what I did. Someone must have interrupted an elder's burial chant." "Well," I said, "that don't matter none. You can finish the chant and send all those corpses back to being dead, so why don't you do it?" Running Dog shook his head. "It is not that easy. I only know a few chants and rituals." He sighed. "I was the son of our tribe's medicine man, but I preferred the paleface's ways to our own. I left my tribe for what I thought were greener pastures, even attended Oxford, and I just returned yesterday. I wish I had never left my people." "So do I," I said. "Don't you remember any chants?" Running Dog nodded. "I know one that can stop someone who is bitten from turning." My eyes instantly went to Charles. "That boy over there, he's been bitten. Can you save him?" The Lakota walked over and gave Charles a quick look. "I believe I can. Bring a bucket of water and some tobacco, some bandages if you can find them, and I will try my best." We gave Running Dog the materials he wanted, and then he set to work. Now, I had seen Lakota fighting, and I knew they were fierce warriors, but I had no idea they could be so tender. Running Dog wiped Charles down, gently caressed the wound, and burned some tobacco next to him, all while chanting in a low voice. When he was finished, some color had returned to Charles's cheeks, and Running Dog had also wrapped and bound the wound. "Thank you," Charles whispered softly, wiping the tears from his eyes. "You are welcome, dear boy." Running Dog came to his feet. "It is done. The child is saved. Now we have to save ourselves." He went over to the window and looked down at the walking corpses. I walked over to Charles, figuring I was the closest thing he had to a father in this town. I took off my long brown coat and wrapped him up in it. "You feeling better, son?" "Yes," Charles said weakly. He smiled. "I can't believe I met a real Indian, and a British one, too." I chuckled and ruffled his hair. Then I went over to where Murphy and Running Dog were talking. It was time to get out of here. "The stables are our best bet," Murphy said. "The only problem is that the dead have clogged up the streets." A lot of time had passed. It was almost midnight, and us survivors had realized that we didn't have enough food to hold out for more than 1 or 2 days. It was time to leave, but that presented a bit of a problem. "If we just had something to clear the way," Running Dog whispered. "It wouldn't be a stroll through Hyde Park, but maybe we could get through." Running Dog's words gave me an idea. "My tools! They must still be here. You guys just wait here a second or two, and I'll give us something to clear the road." I ran out of the room and headed for my room on the bottom floor. I jumped over the barricade and then stopped dead in my tracks. The walking corpses had torn down the door and they were walking around inside the hotel lobby. A thin woman with smashed glasses and a tall young man with no left leg fixed me with hungry gazes. The young man said. He reached out with one hand and grabbed onto my collar. I went for my peacemakers, but they were plumb out of ammo. "Son of a gun, son of a gun," I said, kicking the dead man away and stumbling backwards. "Son of a gun!" I came quickly up to my feet and picked up one of the saloon chairs. I had been in plenty of barroom brawls before, but never one against rotting corpses. The woman came at me, and I slammed the chair into her head. It broke apart and sent her sprawling, her brains spilling out on the floor. Then I grabbed a chair leg and swung it into the one-legged corpse. His skull was soft and spongy, so I whacked him again and again until he stopped moving. I dropped the bloody chair leg, gave the corpse a final kick, and headed to my room. The tools were right where I had left them. There was my 12-gauge, a scoped Sharps rifle from the war, and a few more peacemakers. I reloaded, grabbed all the guns, and then found what I had been looking for, a dozen sticks of candy red dynamite. Yes, sir, Alfred Nobel had outdone himself with the dynamite, and I was happy to have it along. I went back into the lobby and saw a couple more corpses. After easily blowing their heads off with the 12-gauge, I headed upstairs. Murphy, Running Dog, and the rest of the survivors were as happy as I was to see the dynamite. "Now we can finally bust out of here," Murphy said. He picked up one of the dynamite sticks like he was a kid on Christmas morning. "Not so fast," I said. "This stuff is just as likely to blow us to smithereens as it is the dead folks, so we're going to play this careful." I turned to Running Dog and handed him a stick. "You got a good arm on you? I was a champion horseshoe thrower when I was at Oxford," Running Dog said with a smile. "Good. Here's the plan. First, we split into two groups, each with a couple of sticks. We'll have to leapfrog our way to the stables. First group throws, second group runs, then the second group throws while the first one runs. I'll take one group, Running Dog takes the other. Okay?" Running Dog nodded. "And who takes the wounded child?" "I reckon I will." We all stared at each other, as did the other survivors. Some of them had pistols on them. We didn't have nearly enough ammo to hold out against all the hungry dead for too long. This would have to be quick. While they were all getting ready, I walked over to Charles. He was looking better, but still pretty weak. "We're going to get out of here now," I said. "I'm going to put you on my back. You just hold on real tight and we'll make it, okay?" Charles nodded. "Mr. Reaper?" he asked. "Yeah? Those dead people, are they going to eat us?" "Don't you fret, son," I said simply. "I won't let them." Charles looked a little bit better, but he didn't say anything. I picked him up and set him on my back, and he held on as tight as he could. I drew out one of my revolvers and looked it over. It was almost time. I picked up my Sharps rifle and offered it to Running Dog. "Need some firepower?" I asked. "I'm fine, thank you." Running Dog tapped the bow and arrow on his back. "You never forget how to use a Lakota war bow. Let us begin." I lit a match on my boot heel, lit the first dynamite stick, and tossed the dynamite down the stairs, so it could clear out the barricade and any dead people that had walked in. There was a lot of smoke and noise, and the way was cleared. My group, of about 5 folks besides Charles and me, ran out of the Kilgrave Hotel and into the street, blasting away with every gun we had. I'd given my 12-gauge and Sharps rifle to 2 of the townsfolk, and while they weren't no Annie Oakley, they held their own. Just as the crowds of dead folk were about to overwhelm us, Running Dog blew apart another hole in front of us, and we ran into the general store, and then blasted a path for him. Using this pattern, we slowly made our way to the stables. It took a long time, a lot of ammunition, and every single stick of dynamite, but we finally made it. Charles hung on like a limpet, and I was mighty proud of him. But just as I shoved open the doors of the stables, I thought of something. What if the dead folks liked horse meat just as much as human meat? With a sinking feeling in my chest, I peered inside. I was right. The walking corpses had gotten there first, and every horse in the place had been chewed up good. Running Dog and his group ran inside the stable, and then they saw what had happened. "Well, that does it!" Murphy cried. "I've had it with running! Those goddamn red heathens ate everything!" He swung around and aimed his shotgun at Running Dog. "This is all your fault!" "Now calm down, Murphy," I said. "It ain't nobody's fault, so just calm the hell down." Murphy shook his head. "No, this goddamn dirt worshiper did it, and I'm gonna do him in." He was about to fire, I could tell, and there weren't nothing Running Dog or I could do. But then, a hand grabbed Murphy from behind and pulled him backwards. It was a young woman, a Lakota by the looks of her, with a bloody slash in her tan buckskin dress. Running Dog stared at her and watched silently as she tore the screaming Murphy apart. Then, Running Dog notched an arrow to his bow and shot it straight into her head. After he had put another one in what was left of Murphy's head, he turned back to me.
"That was my sister," he said simply. "I would recognize those eyes anywhere." We said no more about it. "There's a train refueling depot a little ways from town," I said, trying to change the subject. "If we can get out there, we'll be safe. Once we explain what happened to the train's engineer, I'm sure he'd give us a ride out of here." "But how are we going to clear away the dead people?" Charles asked, still on my back. "We don't have any more dynamite, and all the horses are dead." "Maybe dead." I walked over to one of the horses, a big feller with his legs all chewed to the bone, and put my hand next to his muzzle. I wasn't completely surprised when he lunged for it. "But the folks outside are dead, and that doesn't slow them down none." It took us a while to saddle up the dead horses, but we did it. We took some pieces of flesh from the dead people outside and hung them from some poles we found in the stable. We used those to lure the horse corpses forward. It was probably the most stinking ride I ever had, but I was sure grateful for it. Then, with me on the horse and Charles on the back holding on to my waist, we rode off. "Yee-haw!" I couldn't help shouting as my horse pounded out of the stable. One of its back legs tore off, but the animal managed well enough with the other three. The survivors rode after me, with Running Dog bringing up the rear. The corpses blocking our way were trampled under the feet of the dead horses, and we left that stinking town to the flies, the vultures, and the living dead. We rode the dead horses until the sun rose and Dead Man's Gulch disappeared behind us. Then, we carefully blasted apart each one of the horses' heads and buried the bodies. We walked the rest of the way to the train depot. It wasn't until I was waiting for the train that I realized just how tired I felt. I fought to stay awake until the train arrived, but there was some nagging sensation in my mind that there was still something I had to do. I shrugged it off and sat down next to Charles. He leaned against my shoulder and closed his eyes. "Where am I going to go now?" he asked in his quaking little voice. "My father is gone, and I don't have any other relatives." I thought for a while and then said, "I reckon I'll send you off to a boarding school. You'd get yourself a first-rate education there." Poor Charles didn't seem to share my opinion of being packed off and sent away. "I don't want to go to a boarding school," he whispered, leaning his curly-haired head against my shoulder. "It ain't going to be that bad," I said hopefully. "Teachers might beat you a few times, but you'll get a good schooling and you'll be safe." "I don't want to go to boarding school," he repeated. "I want to be with you." Well, I don't know if I'd be a good father," I muttered. "I never had much of anything to do with wives and children and such. Sorry, son, I'm just not cut out for it." Then Running Dog kneeled down next to me. "But you were a good father," he said. "When the lad was scared, you comforted him and cared for him. I think you did a capital job." I looked at Charles, and he looked at me. His eyes got all big, and he was looking small and helpless. I gave in. "Oh, hell," I muttered. "Fine, you can stay with me for a bit, until I figure something else out." "Thank you, Mr. Reaper," Charles cried, beaming. "But I'm warning you, it's going to be dangerous. I don't even understand half the outlaws and beasts they're trying to kill me these days, or the outlaws and beasts that I'm paid to kill." "It can't be that dangerous," Charles was interrupted when a metal stick figure with one light bulb still shining from his tiny head burst out from behind a coal pile and fired at me with a Winchester repeater. I hadn't finished off Fire-Eyed Dick, and now he was here to finish off me. The bullet went by my shoulder, and I went for my peacemakers. The mechanical man was working the lever on his rifle when I had his last light bulb eye in my sights. I fired, but the bullet neatly missed. He seemed to gloat at me as he finished working the lever and went for the trigger, but with all his cash register brain-powered intelligence, Fire-Eyed Dick had forgotten one thing. He was standing on a railroad line, and railroad lines are home to trains. Doc Torrent must have forgotten to put ears onto Fire-Eyed Dick, because the mechanical man didn't hear the train coming until it was too late. The train plowed straight into Fire-Eyed Dick, and when it came to a stop, only shards of glass from his light bulb eyes remained. "Like I said," I told Charles as we boarded the train, "it's dangerous." "Oh," Charles said slowly, "where are we going to go now?" "Now? Probably a little town in New Mexico by the name of Roswell.
Heard on the grapevine a while back they've been having some trouble with hovering discs and big-headed babies that can shoot lightning bolts or something. Probably need a feller like me around. I'll go with you, Charles assured me, and he did.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that. If you'd like to learn more about Clark Reaper, go to clarkreaper.com. You can find links to Clark Reaper on Amazon. You can purchase the book there. And you can also find links to other stories and other places of interest around the internet. That's all for today. Next time, we'll see just what happens in Roswell, New Mexico. Thank you, and happy trails.